Welcome to Fertility Fest 2018. I'm Natalie Silverman from the Fertility Podcast, and this session is called The M Word. Now, experts believe one in five pregnancies end in miscarriages, so why do we still not talk about it enough? Here's your chair, Kate Bryan, to tell you more about the session, and you can also watch the video footage at fertilityfest.com.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for coming to this session. My name's Kate, and I'm going to be chairing this bit of time today. We're really lucky today to have some brilliant people with us to discuss the M word, which here at Fertility Fest at this moment in time is not motherhood, but miscarriage. And it's a very important subject that probably doesn't get discussed or recognised or talked about enough. And we've got two brilliant artists and two fantastic experts. Our artists today are Tabitha Moses, who's going to go first, and then Foz Foster. And they're both going to show you their work and talk to you a bit about what they've done and why they've done it. And then we'll be joined for a discussion by our experts as well. And we've got two very eminent professors today. We've got Professor Leslie Reagan, who's the president of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and Professor Simon Fischel from Care Fertility. So you've got the best artists and the best experts to tell you everything that you need to know about miscarriage. So over to you, Tabitha.
Kate. Hello, everyone. If I wander away from the microphone, can you still hear me? Great. Last year I was here talking about IVF and infertility. This year I'm here talking about miscarriage. And I've got to say that when I hit the jackpot and had a baby with the help of IVF, I thought, God, what am I going to make work about now? That was such a juicy subject. And it was always as if I thought, not always, but the third time we were having it after two unsuccessful goes, I thought, well, if it doesn't work, at least I can make some artwork about it. You know, there's always that consolation. But sort of the infertility and the IVF isn't quite such an urgent topic for me now since having a miscarriage after having another go of IVF. So I thought I'd just show you some new work I'm making. Nothing's quite finished, and it's all part of an embryonic project, shall we say. Thinking about food and longing. So I first had a miscarriage in 2010, after getting pregnant naturally. And this is a piece of work I made after that, the first autobiographical work I ever made, or the first explicitly autobiographical, the Islands of Blood and Longing. And so I can remember really needing to make a record or a witness of the fact that I was once pregnant, and this and recording the pregnancy and the miscarriage, or the aftermath of the pregnancy, I should say, and the aftermath of the miscarriage. So this is a drawing about this big made with the blood from the miscarriage and the days following. Charting the cessation of bleeding and return to normal in the days and weeks after the miscarriage. And I think, and to get to the food bit, I remember in the days following the miscarriage, I really sort of needing to recuperate from this big physical trauma, doing a bit of gardening, and it was in springtime, and I planted beetroot and carrot seeds in the back, and I remember thinking to myself, I am going to be pregnant again by the time I'm harvesting these beetroots and carrots. I wasn't, but it really helped that summer to nurture life. Yeah. And it really helped for the drawing and the gardening. It really helped to have a project outside of myself, something to put my energy into. So there's a little close-up of one of the islands. And I felt like making this drawing, purely for cathartic reasons, helped me to sort of navigate my way through those weeks that followed the miscarriage, and sort of charted this unknown territory that I was suddenly in, this unexpected turn of events. And I got really into the meditative quality of making the drawings really precise and then colouring in, so mindful colouring with the blood. And so after, fast forward 7 years, and after three rounds of IVF, one donor egg and one daughter, I was pregnant again with a frozen embryo. I was thinking, all along, both pregnancies actually, both or three pregnancies, I was thinking about how the pregnancy is measured in terms of foodstuffs, the size of the baby, from a poppy seed through olive, avocado, up to a melon, hopefully not much bigger. So that was, you know, that was one of the things I was measuring the pregnancy by. So when this fetus was the size of a large broad bean, its heart stopped beating and I had my second miscarriage. And that idea of the broad bean has always really stayed in my mind. So the miscarriage was in June, and all that summer, not all that summer, but there were points that summer when I was in the local community garden with my daughter and people all around, and someone would get the broad bean pod and open the pod and go, oh, look at these, aren't they lovely, succulent? Do you want to try one? And I could never, didn't want to try one, because all I saw was rows of fetuses in the pod. So I didn't eat broad beans last summer. However, being in that garden, and especially with my daughter as well, and doing the helping out with the garden, and seeing the harvest and the fruits of the labour, again, really helped. And so, however, it was a pretty crap year, the second half of that year. And I didn't really have a creative response to the miscarriage. I found I couldn't make work at all. It was really hard to just find the headspace to sort of lift myself out of whatever I was feeling, to make a creative response. And I found that after the due date, which was the end of November, that was a sort of really emotional time. And then after Christmas, the Christmas of thinking, what should be in my hands here, the Christmas I should be having. After that, the real low point of that, something lifted, and I started to want to think about beans again, and the this broad bean image just stayed in my mind. So I was looking at botanical drawings and made some drawings and some prints. My usual medium is fabric and stitch, hand embroidery. But just as an aside in this talk, not in my life, but I'd wanted to make work that was less deliberate. I'd wanted to make mistakes and do something more accidental, because for me, hand embroidery was a very deliberate and slow, laboured process. So I'd moved into printmaking, and I was really having trouble finding a subject for my work. Making some drawings about my daughter, who I was, of course, head over heels in, well, not necessarily of course, but I was head over heels in love with her. Making drawings of her, but nothing seemed quite right. And I was making these prints about pregnancy, thinking through some ideas that I'd felt when I was actually given birth, ideas I'd had when I was given birth, and they never seemed quite right either. To be glib about it, you know, this miscarriage came at a good time for art-wise. Not that I want to be glib about it, but it feels like I feel really lucky to have this process and to be able to transform horrific events into something meaningful and to find meaning in these life events. I think that's I feel very lucky about that. So to come to miscarriage, it's still quite an urgent topic for me. So I went to images of broad beans, and so these are some prints I've been making earlier this year, looking at botanical imagery, and for the first time looking really at what happens when a bean or a seed germinates, and discovered that within the bean there's a part that's called the embryo. I never knew that. It's amazing. That's got the leaves inside it that actually then grow. Plants have ovaries. It was really fortuitous to find this out and think about the connections between the growing human and the growing plant and the seed. Let's get to another picture. Some more seeds. Beans, growing beans. And it feels like, I'm not sure where this is going. No, I've got an idea where it's going, but I'm not sure what it says or what someone would get from these prints if they didn't know why I'd made them. And I'm okay with that. It's okay for me to just have this little sort of not obsession with beans, but just to be interested in growing beans. I think I'm interested in the germination and the all that potential that's held within there. I'd taken the fetus home from the hospital because it was really important for me to, again, to have this something tangible to tell me that I was pregnant. It wasn't just a dream. And it was in the freezer, in the bottom of the freezer, in a plastic tub, sort of lurking there like a darkness in the bottom drawer of the freezer. And I knew that I wanted to plant it and the placenta under a lavender bush or a small lavender plant that had come from me in-law's garden, because my father-in-law had died recently as well. So for me, that the sort of continuity of the family and remembering those generations or those people is still quite important to me. So the fetus was there. I couldn't confront it. I couldn't look at it. Didn't want to open the tub. But then after a while, I realised that that's what I needed to do. The beans were sort of, I was getting somewhere, but it didn't feel enough. So one day I set myself up and got myself into a centred place and opened the Tupperware tub, and I was really scared, as if I was in a horror film and there was going to be this monster or something there waiting to jump out at me. Or I was scared of the feelings that would come up again and the bigness of the sadness and the trauma and despair and all of those things that were still there. But I found that it was quite a tender day, that first day of drawing this little fetus. This is the print. That's the print and on the right, and this is the printing plate on the left. And I found that first day was a real tender day of drawing the fetus and feeling like I realised that what the more you look at something, the less scary it becomes. And also the act of drawing really helped, because I gave myself, I don't know if it's necessary, but for me then it was necessary to have this distance and to see it as a form with light and shadow and lines and shapes. So, and I really like this. I put the printing plate in there because when you have IVF, I don't know if it happens in every clinic, but we were shown on the screen the little embryos, and this is like black and white screen. And I thought they looked like they were floating in space, and there were little motes of, hopefully not dust or anything, but the screen was a bit fuzzy, and it looked like they looked like heavenly bodies floating in space. And I feel like it feels a bit like that. That reminds me of the screen with the embryos on. And this is an actual size drawing, about 2.5 centimetres, a bit smaller than 2.5 centimetres. And I put it up on Instagram and just said Little Bean, called it Little Bean, after putting the bean drawings up previously, the bean prints. And they got loads of positive responses. And I felt like, and also looking at it, I felt like, oh, it's too sweet, it's too cute. That's not what I was feeling. It doesn't convey the sadness of the experience. And in fact, a friend I saw some months later said, oh, I thought everything was going all right when you posted that picture of the little bean. And so I went back and drew it again. Call it it, because even though it was all formed, I didn't want to go poking around to find out what sex this little person had been. It felt like an indignity to go around, poking around. And also, I didn't want to break its skin or hurt its body in any way. So I went back and made some more drawings, and went back to me sort of early foundation years of doing drawing exercises in order to loosen up and lose control, and drawing with my non-dominant hand, drawing with, what did I do? I just looked at the subject and didn't look at the paper. And I much preferred these drawings, and these are some prints, a couple of prints taken from those drawings. And I really felt like there was the sort of horror. I want to say the word monster, because I was so afraid to confront it at first. There's a monstrousness about it, but I found the humanity in this little person, in its little hands and feet, perfectly formed hands and feet, millimetres big. And I didn't consciously try to capture that in the drawings, but they came out, those little feet are really what's human about it. So they were some prints, and these are some of the drawings. There's also the thought that, I don't know why I miscarried either time, but it's very likely there were chromosomal abnormalities that made the pregnancy unviable, and who knows what physically could have happened to the fetus had it carried on growing, had it been able to, who knows. So there's a sort of, I haven't fully considered this side of it, but there's something about something going a bit wrong in the drawing of a baby or of a fetus, something going a bit wrong in the makeup of the actual fetus. So this act of drawing and then making those drawings into prints really helped me to transform this horrific event into something meaningful. Helped me to take back some agency and not feel like a victim of circumstance. I took back some sort of, I was an active participant in the events. And then this year, it was really important to me to grow broad beans on the allotment. So a few weeks ago, I planted some broad beans, and my daughter helped me. And then just a couple of days ago, I went back to just sort of dig them up and see how they were doing. Having never really witnessed a plant, seen it in real life with its roots and everything. And I was really pleased to see that they were taking root nicely. And I'm looking forward to eating these broad beans. And then in the future, later this year and next year, I really want to work with people who've experienced pregnancy loss and share the growing of food, cooking and eating and sharing stories and experiences, and find a way for people who want to have that sort of creative, creative, the chance to transform their experiences in a creative way. And there we are. Thanks. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Tabitha, for sharing that with us. We now have our second artist, Foz Foster, and I'm just really delighted to have a man here to talk to you about this subject.
Hello. For the visually unaware, I'm a man, which is quite important in this, I think. There's a few factual things I want to give you, which I'm going to read out here because I know I'd forget them, and then we'll get more into the picture side of things. I am a proud dad of two fantastic kids, a boy who's 17 and a girl who's 13, gone at about 25. They're fantastic until obviously we're teenagers, then they're a nightmare. My wife was always keen to have more children, particularly from about the age of 38. I wasn't, I'd had enough at two. However, I came round to the idea, not because she was badgering me to death to have more kids, but just thought, well, why not? Got nothing to lose. She's always been more aware of the practicalities of pregnancy, ovulation, all that stuff. I wasn't, why would I be? I'm a bloke. We didn't try at all, we had two kids. There were, we had sex. Without contraception, it worked. We had two healthy kids, two healthy pregnancies. So the thought of going for a third one made absolutely, you know, fine, let's do that then. We conceived straight away. After 8 weeks, we went to for a scan, and we're told there was no heartbeat, no growth, no baby, no parenthood, no future. Go home and have a miscarriage. This was in 2010, 2011. We then had two further miscarriages within a year. So three miscarriages within 1 year. We were both aged about 42. The miscarriage work actually started with a piece of work which wasn't about miscarriage, which is this one. It was part of an exhibition in New York called Resurrections. The piece itself is called Miscarriages of Justice. It wasn't primarily about miscarriage, but about the normalness, the everyday being extraordinary. And that's really important. We live in a world which is ordinary, but it is extraordinary at the same time. All my work is based on that premise about the ordinary. The work itself was inspired by the crucifixion and a chat with my brother, who's a priest. And I'm an atheist, he's a priest, but we have very similar conversations and similar views, but we just call it different stuff. And I was always fascinated by the crucifixion scene, but not about the gore. There was something quite hypnotic about it for me. And one Sunday afternoon, we had a chat, and he said, well, for some people, it's about a daily struggle. And at that point, it became something really important. And I'm not going to tell you really about all the imagery within this piece of work, just some of the outline bits. It's inspired by, I've said about the crucifixion, about Dorothy and the complexity of the Wizard of Oz characters. It's inspired by a freak show artist called Myrtle Corbin, who had four legs, two vaginas. She gave birth out of both vaginas and was happily married. And I love the uniqueness of individual stories. And it wasn't pointing the finger at her, but it was a celebration of her uniqueness. It also looks at and celebrates my underwear fetishism. It celebrates the Smurfs and Father Abraham, which was the first single I ever bought in 1976. And most importantly, right at the bottom of the page, I'll show you on the next slide, there is two miscarried babies. At this point, I didn't want children until I was in my 30s, when my wife and I had sex without conception. You know, I'm a northern bloke. I think very straightforwardly. People who know me know I'm very straightforward. I'm that straightforward sometimes, it's slightly terrifying. I don't seem to have the filter. It doesn't sort of work with me. So, you know, we stop using contraception equals pregnancy. And for me, it's bizarre me standing up here. Fertility festival, when did this happen? You know, it's bonkers. You know, for me, sex was about lust. It's about shagging. It's about human celebration. It's about looking at each other's intimate bits. It's joyous. It's not about trying. It never has been for me. Which makes me seem like a buffoon with all you fertility people here. You know, it seems bizarre to me, but it's about people, it's about us celebrating each other. Close up. The symbolism of tigers, I'm going to tell you a little bit about this, which will make more sense when we get to the main piece of work I want to talk about. A tiger in its personality is selfish, it's a loner, and can be quite aggressive. It's me. Whenever you see a tiger referenced in the work, it's always me. And if you ever look at what I do in a broader context, you will see lots of references to tigers. But it's always about, that's me in the work. The important bit of this work, I think, was it was really inspired by a lot of sentences from my close friends and family who asked, how's your wife, after the miscarriages? And it really, really fucked me off. Because it's not an attention thing. It's not about, oh, look, please look at me. It's not that. It says me standing on a stage. It's about actually, it takes, I think, even now I'm starting to doubt that, does it take two people to have a baby? I think it is. But maybe there's other things which happens now to make babies. I don't know. But in my head, it takes two people to have a baby, but it only seems that one person has a miscarriage. That made absolute no sense to me. Okay, right. This is my family. Quite an old photograph now. The most important person in this picture took it. It's my wife. And the reason I'm putting this here is really, I couldn't make the work about miscarriage without having babies. Because it's actually using my experience of being a dad in the scroll work, which you're about to see. Some other things I'll put in that didn't fit in anywhere else, I'll fit in now. When we went to the hospital to have the scans, we were in a waiting room. And we then also went back to that same waiting room with expectant parents after being told to have a miscarriage. It was so wrong. At the same time we were having these miscarriages, or just afterwards, I should say, I contacted the Miscarriage Association and vented my anger to the director, which was Ruth Bender-Attick, who was brilliant, who really just said, how right, how sad. And she started explaining that they were going to do a campaign to do with men and miscarriage. I said I wanted to earn a few quid and did a few long runs, the marathon and et cetera, which was great because I think for the first time I actually felt I was part of something else, something bigger. And that felt very important to feel that support. Me and my wife never really talked about miscarriage afterwards because we had nothing to say about it, I don't think, apart from this is awful. What's the point of going over the same ground all the time? It's awful. It's a dead-end conversation, which seems really bizarre now, having lectured around the country for the last 4 years talking about it. But it also highlights, for my wife, it was privacy. It was about her story to her, no one else. For me, it was exactly the opposite. Okay. Right, miscarriage. Where do you start in the creative process with it? As a visual person, sometimes you can have so many ideas in your head, you have nothing, because it's just a wash. It's like blight. The nearest I can describe it is when you're in a panic, you've got no clarity. Visually, when you've got too many ideas, it's the same. So you're always looking for kind of thoughts which will unblock the dam in a way. This photograph is my son on holiday, and these inflatables, which we've all mucked around on, are probably on a holiday somewhere, and they're just joyous. You don't look at an inflatable and think, how sad. It makes you smile and laugh. People have fallen off them. They're great. And for me, these are great props, and I started exploring these props of these inflatables. I bought hundreds back from holiday. If the security had actually opened my suitcase, they'd have got a shock. But they're props, they're reference points, and if you're an underwear fetishist, your natural thing is to go, I'm interested in pubes. There's a link, okay? So, the next bit will make more sense. So I started looking at visually what I'm interested in is things which are opposite. Shiny things, matte things, smooth things, textured things. It's all about the vibrancy and about the clash. I'm interested in things which clash. So these are some of my inflatable sketchbooks almost. We've got his and her hair beds. I had an arrangement with my barber, which I used to give him beer for bags of hair. That's how it worked. And again, it was me just thinking aloud this. I don't see these as like works of art. These are just me thinking. These are, they're joyous, but they're repellent. Hair, when it's removed from the body, is rance. It's absolutely disgusting. So these are joyous yet rancid at the same time. This one's slightly more specific. It's Love You to the Moon and Back. With the kids, when you say goodnight to them, they never shut up. They'll always want to stay up. So, love you to the moon and back. And then my daughter would go, love you in the moon and back again. Lovey to the moon back times 10. Lovey to the moon back times 20. Then it would go on for hours, this. Lovey to the moon back infinity times. This is where it goes. I'm a 70s kid, space hoppers. Interestingly, when I was doing the scroll work, which we are coming to it, no one would do anything about it in terms of the media. It appeared that miscarriage is a taboo. Men and miscarriage is just a no-go, it seemed to me. This was at the back end of the Miscarriage Association, using their journalists with their kind of, no one would touch it. Until the morning of the Labour Love exhibition, the journalist who'd written the piece rang out and said, the Guardian are going with it. He was doing a three-quarter page spread, which was amazing. But yeah, I'm sure if Jessica had done, they would have probably given her the whole page. But, you know, but it's like, you know, for us normal folk. I'm an illustrator, trained. The leading illustration journal did a thing about it, which was great. Cass Arts, which is the UK's leading art suppliers, did a whole feature about the work, which is obviously fantastic. And in terms of spreading the story of miscarriage, it's an awareness thing. It's more, you know, I've lectured all around the country about this, and people do want to talk about it, but someone has to start the conversation. Okay, right, the main event, the scroll. So, this scroll, it's 76 feet long and 3 feet wide. It's called Pin Will Not Have the Last Word. It explores my relationship with my three miscarried children. It's a double-edged sword, it's a celebration and a mourning of our kids. In my mind, they're not cells or embryos or statistics, they're lives and people and humans. So, where do you start with something like this? Because obviously it's vast, it's huge. As I said before, I'm very straightforward. So, and I should say, this scroll of paper was never meant to be a thing. I just collect papers all the time, and at some point I use them with no great purpose, just to keep things interesting for me. One day, and also the other thing I should say is, when I know what I'm going to draw, I won't do it, because it's boring. Why would I do something I already know exists? It's a waste of time. So, artistically, it needs to be something interesting, something new, which I don't know. So the scroll, when I decided to, one bored afternoon in the studio, as soon as I sat down and put ink to paper, I knew this was going to be something important. Where do you start? Okay, I start, my babies are dead. Why did you leave me without saying goodbye? And obviously you can start seeing the inflatables start coming in. So what you're going to see is a series of sections from the scroll. So they all lean on one by one. The tiger. And this is where the hair thing comes in. If a cat, you know, obviously they lick their fur, they have fur balls. It's a repellent thing. It's a thing which they can't control. They gag. To me, that was the nearest I could think about in terms of miscarriage. It was out control reflex, the body's reflex. So in my head, the tiger was going to give birth or to be sick to three hairy children. And it's that double-edged sword. It's repellent, but they're children. Everything throughout the work is a double-edged sword between a beautiful thing and a horror story. Obviously, I can talk about lots of individual bits in there, but I won't bore you. So, as the story progresses, you give birth to the children. At home, my wife was in huge pain, huge loss of blood. It was terrifying. I remember her asking me to have a look in the toilet to see if there's a baby. I didn't have a clue what I was doing, you know, it was horrendous. It was like a scene out of a Tarantino movie, you know, and no one prepares you for this. And it's a huge, huge shock. And, you know, I'm lucky enough to be able to express it through a creative process. But people who can't do that and are carrying that, I think there needs to be a responsibility beyond the fact that you know, I think the nearest we got to it, there was a leaflet on the way out the door to go into the waiting room with other expectant parents. Have you been just told your babies are dead? So bits of this reference, you know, from an outside point of view, I'm an award-winning artist, award-winning lecturer, international artist, blah, 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 very successful. Behind that veneer of importance and respectability and success, my life was falling apart. You know, so there's lots of reference to do with inside what was going on. At this point, the other thing I should say, actually, the most difficult bits of this visually was trying to connect the scenes so it felt like one continuous drawing. So, for instance, the railings of the fence become the railway sleepers to the next scene. And throughout the whole picture, there's the connectives. That's really important visually. As it progressed, I started lecturing about this work, you know, 10 feet in, 20 feet in. And at first, it was, I was really nervous about it. Because as much as I'm standing here now going, no, it is a man's issue, and I knew it was a man's issue, going into a lecture hall full of mainly female students, because historically this is a female issue, but it wasn't to me. But actually going into that environment, talking about this was terrifying, actually. But the response was amazing and unexpected. The response, what came back was, you need to do this. This is a man's issue. Of course you've got to sell it. Everywhere I went, people were coming to me in tears, saying, this has happened to me. Please talk more about this, both men and women. So the other thing which is important about this is, at this point in the work, I decided I was going to play with my kids for the time I didn't have with them. So what do with kids? Okay. You got the fun fair. The other thing I should say about this as well is, I was at the start of this, I was actually quite nervous about if this was just going to turn into some dark spiral and maybe send me over the edge slightly without being too dramatic. But it actually did the opposite. It was so uplifting to do. It was literally spending time with the children. And that was a great privilege. Kids are selfish. You know, look, Dad, look at me. Look at how important I am. As the work progressed, I realized it was starting to become as a timeline, so it became seasonal. And it started looking at different festivals throughout the year. So Easter egg hunts, looking for fertility, looking for the egg. Going to the park. Having had two kids, I've whinged and felt so depressed like many other parents in the park at 6:30 in the morning going, why am I here? It's absolutely horrendous. You know, it's as much as I love my darlings, yeah, I would like to have been in bed. At this point, I started looking at other men's stories online and started realizing that actually there were so many fellas were feeling helpless, lonely, selfish, frustrated, angry, sad, useless, questioning their masculinity. And I just thought, this isn't just my story. This is actually a collective story. So I started including their story within the imagery. You know, within something like this kind of artwork, there's lots of stories which are the first major communication, but there's actually lots of other secondary levels to the communication. You know, things like, I was Fozzie Bear at school, I was the class clown. You know, which people, it isn't important, but it's important to me to draw. You know, part of drawing and part of making work is about being selfish. It's indulgent. It's for me, it's my time, it's my privacy. You know, this is a very public piece of work now. But for 2 years, it was mine. visually speaking, things are about connections. You know, you see three spare soppers, almost like a totem pole. Well, that gives me license to make a teepee next to it because you know that it's a totem pole. I use your experience visually to allow me to do what I need to tell you. But it's your knowledge, not mine. And we go play hide and seek in the forest. Throughout the whole piece, there's threes of everything. Three trees, three blah, blah, three inflate. You know, it's the thing. Threes are is the magic number. The bit on the right is the bit I want to talk about here. The kids dressed as presents. It was my granddad at Christmas used to sit there. And me and my cousins used to go, "Granddad, what's the best present you've had?" And he used to go, "You're my best presents." And obviously we just laughed at him. He said, "But what have you got me, you know?" It references him. Christmas, my favourite time of year. It's kids' favourite time of year as well. It's fantastic. I love the naffness, the stupidity, the presents, let's face it. So there's lots of different references. There's obviously very diagrammatic references to childbirth in there. There's three ho-ho-hos. There's all sorts of stuff going on. As a kid snowing, it's a wonderful thing. Going sledging, playing snowballs, it's a joy. But obviously all this work, you know, these are hairy snowflakes. You know, you look at that. And what I also got interested in, is going back to the first slide, the crucifixion thing. As a symbol, it is used so often. And we see it so often, we just don't recognize it in a religious context. You know, I've got the snowman. Footballers scoring goals. Teddy bears sit like that. The airport, when you greet people, I love the arrivals part in airports. You know, seeing families run together, or you get the more formal kids shaking their person's hand. You know, I love it. It's a joy, it's a celebration, but it's also a struggle. Daily struggle. Goes back to that. You go on holiday as a family. Amazing. Come back and you do the washing. The hardest part of this work was finishing it. And I was trying to think about how, I mean, obviously I could just shove another bit of paper on the end and go, "Oh, I'll start again." But I didn't. I felt like there needed to be a gap. And I was also interested in how artists sign their work. And as it happens, Dad's got three letters, which seemed to make sense. So Dad signed it above the three empty graves. This is the last thing I want to say. The more I've talked about it, the more I've realised that it acts as a portal, a doorway. If that doesn't sound too tossy, it allows people to talk about their experiences. And when people see the work, they seem to own it themselves. And that's a great power and a great privilege to have done. Yeah, that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Foz. I'd like to call our experts, Leslie and Simon, now to come and join us on the stage for a discussion with Tabitha and with Foz as well. Thank you both so much. Do you want to come and... Thank you. I mean, I found that incredibly moving. And one of the things that you said, Foz, about you in all of your work and thinking about life as being ordinary yet extraordinary, it really struck me that that kind of applies to miscarriage in some ways, doesn't it? Because it's so common, and yet when it happens to you, it's so huge and so overwhelming. I mean, I wondered if you wanted to just... Do you need a microphone? Yeah. You just talk.
I don't have a prize on it. Yeah, you do feel like the only one in the universe going through it, I think. It's funny, having gone through successful pregnancies where I remember me and my wife, and she's here, so she'll agree, that we'd agreed that we weren't going to tell anyone. But we were at a party at our house, and I got drunk, and then told everyone halfway through the inn that we were going to have a baby, like, you know, sad northern drunken man. And she's going, what do you tell them? That might go wrong. And obviously it didn't with the first few. But that, I think culturally, we've got that. We've got that thing that we need to keep it private because it can go wrong. And it shocks me. It still does. It's part of it going wrong is as much a part of it as going right, in a way. And I just think people should feel confident in that sharing. And the other thing about it, which shocks me, is that you're keeping it private from the people who care about you, which doesn't make any sense either to me. So if it goes well, that's brilliant. So you share in the enjoyment. Or if it goes wrong, you want them there to support you. But we don't.
That's very true and very interesting. Sorry, the thing I forgot to do when we sat down was reintroduce everyone again.
Okay.
Just for the audience, this is Professor Leslie Rehin, and this is Simon Fischel and Tabitha and Foz, you've met already. Leslie, I wanted to bring you in at this point because obviously, you know, running a clinic where miscarriage is something that you're dealing with every day, do you find that people actually, until it happens to them, just have no idea how common that is?
Absolutely. So I was just thinking about when I first became really interested in miscarriage as a doctor, and I was a very junior registrar in Cambridge in the 1980s, so now I've dated myself. And what was so extraordinary was that almost every night I was on call, I would be dealing with parents who had lost their baby, and of course, the question they asked me was, well, why did it happen? And at that time, well, Simon will remember, back in the 1980s, there wasn't very much you could say apart from, well, this is nature's way of sorting things out. And I was incredibly frustrated by the fact that this was happening every day in front of me. I was working in a very big hospital, and I was the only person on call at night, and I couldn't give anybody any information back. So I suppose one of the things that I've learnt since then is that most of the couples that I talk to can cope with bad news, but what they find most difficult to cope with is no news or not understanding. And I was interested in your point about holding things privately, because I empathise with your point that the people that you're withholding it from are the people that can probably provide you with much comfort. But I think there is... as humans, if you have feelings about these things, I think you hesitate to tell people because you actually want to protect them from it. And what I often see of people, or mothers and fathers who were longing to have a baby, wanting to hold it privately, not because they feel failures or because they feel that they can't talk about it, but because they don't want other people to be traumatized by their loss. Or traumatized for them. I mean, if you were to tell one of your parents about losing a baby, they would feel immediately distressed for you. And I think a lot of people are trying to protect the people around themselves when they hold on to it.
It's interesting that my mum and dad had two miscarriages, and I made a short film about doing the scroll a while ago, and we interviewed my dad. And he got really upset because it's the first time in 45 years he'd ever talked about it. And I think things are improving. But I think that, I don't know if it's a British thing, that we want to... how do you describe it? It's... we got counsellors to get support, but then we don't want to burden our friends and nearest and dearest with that stuff. I don't quite get it. I just don't understand. And if they're friends and loved ones, then you want that support.
I think that's one of the other things that I found really interesting listening to both of you, was how much working through... you talked a lot, both of you, about your creative process to getting to be able to make this work. And I wanted to ask you a bit about that, Tabitha, because you obviously actually found it really
both of you quite therapeutic, and I wondered if you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, I think there is a sense that, I touched on it in my talk, where there's a sense that this horrific thing has happened. And what you say, Leslie, about the uncertainty is a big part of it for me as well, especially with the work about infertility. There's a sense that I need to do something, because this thing happened to me. I want to actually do it, do something and be active and make something meaningful of it. Yeah, there's definitely a sense of finding meaning in it.
And you wanted to share that with other people then going forwards through your...
Not necessarily share the meaning I've found. I make the work primarily for me, but I really feel that that ability to talk about it and share the story and almost unburden myself is so good. And like you, Foz, the work has opened up so many conversations with people who we wouldn't ordinarily be talking about miscarriage or infertility with each other. I just think the more we talk about it, the more you look at something, the less scary it becomes.
One of the things, actually, Foz, that you said that I wrote down at the time you said it, because it really struck me very strongly, was you said, it takes two people to have a baby, but one person has a miscarriage. And that is, it's really extraordinary when you think about it, the way we do think that miscarriage happens to a woman.
Yeah, no, I didn't understand that. And these are, like, incredibly close friends. That there was nothing ill thought about it from it. You know, I know they care deeply about me, but it didn't come into the conversation. It was bizarre. And I still find it bizarre.
Simon,
I think miscarriage, pregnancy, fertility treatment all happen to women. I was always conscious in the fertility clinic of when they called my name, I'd say, and Jim.
Simon,
that's a part of a continuum.
I think it might be useful to bring Simon, as someone who actually runs a fertility clinic, to talk a bit about that. Sorry, I think you might need to share your mic then, unfortunately.
Well, it was interesting what Professor Reagan was saying as well, because in 1980, when Professor Reagan was starting to get interested in miscarriage, I was working, just opened, in fact, Septon Edwards just opened the first IVF clinic in Cambridge, just outside Cambridge, Bourne Hall. And I've been working with Bob Edwards since 1975, and so we were just interested in actually trying to help people get pregnant. And what strikes me in a lot of all of this, and I relate to it in many ways, and I relate to it professionally, because I've been trying to help people have babies all my professional life, but we also lost one at 22 weeks, and my daughter's now going through, she's just had a miscarriage. And so it affects everybody in so many different ways, and for me, professionally, it was about words that you use all the time, but you use it in your creative sense. It's meaning and understanding. So my life's been trying to understand what the problems are and how we can perhaps find solutions, or at least explain the reasons why they happen, be it infertility or be it miscarriage. And for us, it was an enormous frustration when couples come to us, patients come to us, trying to conceive, and we help them conceive. We help the embryo come into existence and then implant in the womb, and then it gets lost. And of course, as Professor Reagan said, we knew nothing about it in those days, or very little about it in those days. We know a lot more about it today. Not that we have very easy solutions or we can very easily stop it happening, but at least trying to get an understanding to what's going on is very important, because we often talk about miscarriage, and I remember having this conversation just recently with my daughter when she'd just gone through it, as I said, that, well, what is it? It's actually different. It's medically different for different people. A miscarriage may be something that has happened just after a pregnancy test, or it may be something that's happened as it did for us in a pregnancy where the baby was 23 weeks. You know, there's that huge range, and what is the cause, and what's... So meaning understanding for me, in a sense, a medical science aspect, in my professional career.
One of the other things I think that really struck me in what you were saying, Foz, was just not being prepared to deal with the ghastliness of what actually happened at home.
Yeah, it's, you know, you hear the word sometimes, you know, every now and again, but no one ever says what that word looks like. You know, what happens, you know, it was literally going, I will go home, lie down, and it'll happen. I mean, it was as crude as that. And, you know, and also the pain for my wife, what she was going through, physical pain. No one ever really tell... it's interesting, the hard facts of it and the science of it, we weren't really told that either. Even just going, well, it's going to be agony, this probably. It could be, or it could be, there could be monumental amount of blood. You know, and that very graphic, even though you know, obviously no one wants to think about that, it's horrible. But it is the reality, and it's coming to both parents' way very soon when you're told that news. And just to have that and going, well, is that normal? You know, is that all right? Should I be going to casualty now? Is the rest of my body going to fall out? You know, what's going to happen? And I think it's terrifying for both people.
Leslie, do you think we should do more? Do you think doctors should do more to prepare people for that?
We can always do more, but I was just reflecting as you were saying that, and also your pictures of the bean, your broad bean, is that... I think the audience today, if they're here because they've had an experience of it, you're so much better primed to understand what's happening than, for example, my mother's generation, where they didn't have any form of ultrasound. I mean, it was when I was a junior SHO that B-time ultrasound scanners first came in. So we had they had no concept at all of what it was. And I do remember talking to quite an elderly woman when I was still a trainee who'd come in for a hysterectomy. And she was telling me about her obstetric history. And she told me that she lost a baby. She'd had to have a termination of pregnancy because this baby had spina bifida. And she started crying. And I said, I'm very sorry. And I was probably very inadequate in what I was saying. But she said, well, you see, I never knew what that meant. And so she lived, and this was when she was a teenager, and she was now 80. And so she'd lived the rest of her life. I don't expect she and her partner, her husband, had sex again because she was terrified of becoming pregnant. And when I went off and found a book with a picture of a baby with spina bifida on it and showed it to her, she was so relieved. In fact, she used to write to me every year until she died, because she said it was just such a relief, because I just assumed I had delivered or my baby was a monster. I just didn't know. So I know that's a very extreme example, but it really taught me something, because we have so much understanding because of articles that are written, but mostly because of the imaging, the ultrasound imaging that we all know. So you know, you could recognize those pictures as something from an ultrasound scan. But in answer to your question, Kate, yes, I think a lot of people are very frightened by blood. And when it's coming from a very intimate part of your body, of course you think, I think you put it really well. You wonder if the rest of your body's going to fall out too. And I'm sure that Simon would agree with me. We take it for granted, I think, as gynecologists who deal with that all the time, that the woman and the man that we're talking to that's having a problem understands the anatomy. I mean, I'm always drawing pictures, and often people question, well, where's that bit go to? And I think that really it goes back again to people can usually cope with information, even very upsetting information. It's when they don't know. So when your wife wondered whether the rest of her body was going to fall out, if somebody could have shown her a picture to show that actually the contents of the uterus, or rather the uterus, is quite separate from the rest of the tummy cavity, and therefore nothing could fall out of that too. I'm getting a bit technical now, but you know what I mean. You know, the point is that when things are shown to you, particularly in pictorial form, that it's much easier to grasp it and to feel reassured. But yes, I think blood in particular, I think, you know, because some people are very squeamish about blood and bits of tissue and things.
Talking about being slightly squeamish, Tabitha, one of the things, the visions that sticks in my head is of you having this fetus in your freezer. And when you were talking about it, you said at one point it was lurking like a darkness and that you were afraid to confront it. I found that really incredibly moving. I wonder if you could was it a process to kind of actually look at it? Was that part of your healing process?
I think it was, and I just want to let you know, it's still in the freezer, but it's not a darkness, and I've got my window of time for planting it. So what was the question? Was that part of the process of confronting it? Yeah, definitely, and it felt much better after I had taken it out and looked at it and sort of said hello again and goodbye properly as well.
And I think the other thing that struck me listening to you both talking was how you'd got to that point of being pregnant. And Foz, for you, you know, it was a straightforward, joyous process. And Tabitha, for you, you'd been through all that to get there. And Simon, I always feel that somehow having a miscarriage after you've gone through all that fertility treatment to actually get there feels like doubly unfair somehow. I wondered, you know, is that your experience with patients at the clinic?
Yes, it's disastrous. Because it's interesting, I was talking to somebody earlier about there was an organisation set up years ago called Ace Babes, because women and their partners felt that there was nothing out there that could really help those who, although their pregnancy, if they went through fertility treatment, for example, was no different to any other pregnancy, to them it was special because each of them had this often incredibly hard road to get to that pregnancy. And so they formed this charity, and I was honoured to be its first president, called Ace Babes, which was to help them understand to get a lot of support for those women who had become pregnant by this route, because for them it really was something special, where the others said, well, so what, you know, you're pregnant, you're having a baby. For them it was something very different. And yet, to imagine going back just a little bit early in that journey and you're on it, and then to lose it, I think all what we're hearing today as well is very, very important. It's very personal, and that pain and that individual tragedy can only be expressed by the individual, because each feel it differently. And not talking about it is even more painful. But they prefer not to talk about it, many of them, and so they're almost in a vortex. It's very, very an emotional vortex. It's very hard. It's very hard. And especially when they've worked so hard with many professionals and counsellors and others to try to achieve that pregnancy.
I think one of the things that also came through, particularly from what you were saying, Foz, was about the sense of taboo about talking about it. I mean, did you find that taboo, or is it perhaps easier to talk about it to your friends as a woman?
I feel like all my mates and family knew we were trying to get pregnant, so they all knew when I got pregnant, then they all knew when I had a miscarriage. However, I remember the first one, I was teaching and I had the miscarriage during the Easter holidays, and a colleague, when we went back after, luckily during the Easter holidays actually, so when we went back after Easter, I was sitting at lunch with a colleague, and she told me then that she was pregnant, and so that was a big, like, big moment, and I didn't tell anyone else. I didn't tell her, and I didn't tell anyone at work. But all my close people knew.
And Foz, what about for you? Talking about it as a man, did you talk to other men about it?
I'm not speaking for men generally. I only speak for my own sense. But when I go out with my friends, we generally talk about nothing. You know, we just talk about rubbish. We talk about football, having a beer, some laughing at each other. You know, it doesn't go that much further. And it's only if you really want to raise it. And I think there was, you know, we certainly wouldn't be saying we're trying for a baby. I mean, why do you want to talk about that? You know, there's got to be something more interesting than talking about trying for a baby. But I think it was there with my close friends if I wanted to, definitely. Certainly with family if I wanted that.
And have you found since? You said that a lot of people have spoken to you about it since. Has it been men and women?
Yeah, definitely. It's been a real revelation, actually, seeing how people it seems, I might be over-egging it, but I think somehow people feel, when they look at the work, that it's all right to talk about it, somehow. And that really surprised me. But it encouraged me as well to, well, actually, people do want to talk about this. It's not private, actually. And it's been quite a privilege to see that come about. And people, you know, you've never met Covenant and gone, oh, by the way, blah, 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 you know, and yeah, quite amazing, really.
Leslie, do you notice that in the clinic that women are perhaps more open than men when they're talking about it or not?
No, I don't think they are. I just think the men don't have that much bandwidth. And there's still quite a lot of women who come to the clinic on their own. And I work in Paddington, so it's quite multi-ethnic. And there are lots of cultural mores about this, as you all know. And there are some, quite a large percentage of women I see still who think it's their problem and that they've got to get it sorted. But I was again reflecting the single thing that I'm asked more than why did it happen and why me is I didn't realise it was so common. And now that I've had a miscarriage and for some reason my neighbour knows about it or my best friend, they've told me about theirs. And so despite our attempts to be open and transparent and to talk about these things, and despite the fact that you can buy a pregnancy test in Boots or even the news agent, and you can diagnose your own pregnancy and you can go and buy an ultrasound scan whenever you want, there is still this taboo about it all. And I'm frankly still puzzled, and I have quite a lot of hands-on experience of it. But I think it's also fear, and something I mentioned earlier, I think a lot of women and men feel that it's, well, they compartmentalize it as in an unsuccessful part of their life, which some we will even go so far as to say it's a failing in their life, that they've not been able to have a successful pregnancy, whatever that is.
And we have, don't we? There's still it's well, you're pregnant. Don't say anything until you know there's a yeah. heartbeat on the scan. Yeah. So, you know, when you've been to the clinic and you've had a scan and it's confirmed, then but until then, don't say anything. Mm-hmm. Exactly what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. And it's also the thing I think of other people not. I mean, I wonder if this is something that you two have both experienced. When people do know, sometimes perhaps they don't know what to say to you, so they don't say anything. And maybe that lack of acknowledgement is sometimes quite unhelpful as well.
I don't know whether it's just me, but I haven't noticed that. I haven't been sensitive to that. I don't know about you, Foz. Did you have any of that?
No, I mean, a lot of, I suppose, my close friends would go, it's crap. If you want to talk about it, where if you don't, we'll talk about something more meaningless. But knowing that was there was important, whether you did talk about it, but there was there wasn't an empty silence, no.
I wonder if anyone in the audience has any questions at all. I'd really like to hear from some of you as well. Yes, just there. I think there's a microphone.
There is also one with a mic on the stage, just to say.
Hi. Hello. My question is for Andrew. I'm really was really interested on you touching upon masculinity. I wanted to ask if you felt that your friends could support you through this, and did you feel relief from like the sort of mindless chatter?
However much I did the work, however much I talk about it, the fact remains we didn't have a baby. Mm. Nothing is ever going to mask that. Nothing is ever going to help that. The emotional side of it, yeah. And I did get that support. But I got the biggest support out of doing the work. Mm. My work's my best friend. As sad as that sounds, that's where I do my talking. And I know I could talk for the world, but that's where I do my real talking. It's where I discover what I think. And it's where I'm more eloquent. But my friends and family were there if I needed it.
Anyone else have a question? Yes.
Hi there. It's a question that's a bit sort of connected with what you just said, really. I suppose it could apply to both artists, but Tabitha, you've mentioned that your fetus, your baby's in the freezer and you're going to perform a ceremony. I guess that, but... I was just curious to learn about, Foz, how you feel towards this enormous scroll now. I imagine it's rolled up somewhere, and I imagine also you've got other pieces of work in your studio that... I mean, I got the sense that, as you talked about your work, I mean, I really enjoyed that celebration bit, that it serves as a memorial. You know, there is no gravestone or a funeral. So whether, going around the houses really here, but just whether that scroll lying there, wherever it is, feels like a kind of memorial, whether it feels different to other bits of work.
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things. I think, it's a memorial to the three children who didn't survive to become alive. But also it's a memorial to the subject, I think, in a broader sense. And I think it's again, I'm careful about saying this, but this is what's beginning to emerge. I think it's a memorial for lots of people, I think. I could be wrong there. That might just be me wishful thinking, but I think the more I talk about it, the more I show it, the more people are taking something for it. And that's why I think it's actually... I've spoken to people before. I was just talking to my brother today about it. He said, how much would you flog it for? And I was saying, well, it's quite a lot of money, actually. But more importantly, I wouldn't want to sell it to one person, because I think it's a collective ownership. I would like it to be seen in a museum. Not for my own ego, but I actually think it's... It's not just my story. Yeah, I was the catalyst of the story, but it's people on the work, I think.
Thank you. Any other? Yes, down the front.
Thank you. I was just wondering about actually some of the medical terminology around miscarriage, because certainly my experience was in hospital after an ERCP and ERPC rather, that being called a missed abortion. And I remember being very upset when I received the histology confirming that there was no mole of pregnancy. And obviously it talks about the products of conception. And I was very distressed by talking about, partially necrotic tissue. And I luckily was prepared for the fact that when the karyotyping came through, that it was going to tell you whether the baby was a boy or a girl. But friends weren't, and it was incredibly distressing. And the language around that, to somebody else, yes, medically it is necrotic tissue, but to me that was my baby. And I just wondered what kind of the thinking around that kind of congruence between the medical terminology and what that actually means to the patient.
I think that's one for you, Leslie, perhaps.
I think it's quite complex, because on the one hand, I think many women I see really want to, they want to ensure that all medical facilities or diagnostic tools have been used, because they want the event to be taken seriously. And on the other hand, there's a need, if you like, to translate those into a different form of words. But sometimes if you'd come to me in front of the clinic, there is a chance that my translating it into, well, these are your baby's tissues, and it looks like that there was no abnormality in the placenta or the afterbirth, but actually the baby's chromosomes weren't quite right. And I've done that and completely misjudged the person sitting beside me. If you hit the wrong note at the wrong moment, I've had someone say to me, please don't patronise me. So I suppose, and Simon I think would agree with me, we spent the last 35, 40 years trying to make a judgment which is very, very biased, because, the judgment is you walk through the door. I've probably not met you before. I'd like to think I had, because you'd miscarried at my hospital or whatever, and I'd already met you. But the reality is I probably won't have met you before. And so I'm using all my antennae and experience to try and judge or try and gauge where I should pitch this, what I know is going to be an emotional discussion. And I suppose what I'm saying, or I'm paraphrasing, is that just like everybody else, I get it wrong sometimes. But I think the complexity of medical terms is particularly daunting for couples who are bereaved and have just lost something very precious.
I think also sometimes they can sound very insensitive, actually, can't they? I mean, I don't know what you think about that, Simon.
I just don't think you can ever get it right. I think it's very important that there has to be between professionals medical jargon, because they need to know what they're talking about. And they need to understand the situation. That needs to be translated as empathetically and as sensitively as possible to the recipient of, the patient, the man, the woman, of this really awful news. But do you ever get it right? Can you ever put yourself in somebody else's moccasins? and walk their mile? No, you can't. But I think we need to hear what you say, and we need to be sensitive to, there is a real gulf between an individual's pain and some medical report.
I can just add something to that as well. Because my clinic at St Mary's was one of the first to be set up in the country. Not so common now, but I get a lot of referrals from elsewhere. And it's a very biased elsewhere referral group because, of course, they're the patients that haven't been sorted out. And so I tend to see people who are very dissatisfied with the treatment that they've had if they've come from a long way away. But the common theme, if we're to pick a common theme, is that people didn't give them the information they wanted and it wasn't medicalised enough and it was dismissed as just something like that. So I'm hearing what you're saying and I'm glad you weren't frightened by the terminology was used. But I think if you took a straw poll of all the people who've had a miscarriage in this last year, more of them will be upset by not having a diagnosis and not having their products of conception sent off for analysis than would be distressed by the medicalisation, if you see what I mean.
Can I just add to that? Because we live in a world of information overload, as we all know now, and actually we get follow-up, either calls or patients writing to us saying, they've actually read this on the internet, does this apply to them? Because it hasn't been explained in this detail. And so people are actually wanting more information than maybe has been given to them simply because out there is more information. Did it apply to them?
Yeah. Another question. Yeah. Thank you. We have another question over there, I think.
I worked some years in a rural community as a community midwife, and we found there was very big problems for people who lost their pregnancy less than 24 weeks and managed to negotiate an area where those babies could be buried, and found that was really important for the families to actually acknowledge the loss they'd have rather than it be a miscarriage and not the baby and the child they've got hopes and dreams about.
From personal experience, I think that's extremely important, because I remember when my wife was losing the pregnancy, she wanted nothing to do with what she was delivering, absolutely nothing at all. And it was the senior midwife, who we knew very well at the hospital, that begged me to get her to hold the baby and to have some sort of bonding with this loss, because she said it will in time become a bigger problem, that she wanted nothing to do with this miscarriage. And in fact, it was the best advice that was given at the time.
Well, I think what Tabitha was saying about having the baby, the embryo, and looking at what it looks like ties in with the lady who didn't know what spina bifida meant and thought she had a monster. People don't recognise this. You know, they need to see who it was.
Does that happen routinely, Leslie? Or is Tabitha quite unusual?
No, I think it happens very commonly. But then I only see women who've had repeated loss. So I think they have become even more vigilant, if you like, and even more conscious or cognizant of what they need for themselves. But the worst anger, and which I entirely empathise with, is when a woman says, and then the baby was delivered and it was taken away from me, and then it was lost, or a piece of the placenta didn't get to the laboratory or something like that. And the anger and the frustration and the impotence of that is absolutely horrible to witness, which I'm sure everybody can empathise with as well. So I think we've got a lot to be grateful to for ultrasound and things like that, it's taken away some of the fear factor, albeit I appreciate the fact that bleeding and pieces of tissue coming away for somebody who's got no medical background is frightening, but it's a lot less frightening now, I think, than it was a couple of generations ago.
I think also you two, in the work that you do, are really helping other people to deal with this and to understand it and to talk about it. And I think that's such an important thing to do. I mean, I found it was really interesting that you said that so many people had talked about it to you afterwards who would never have otherwise had those conversations.
Yeah, no, I agree. Something I wanted to say about just the language, about the language of infertility, or the language of even the word infertility to me was like, I never used that word until I was mid-40s probably, you know, just it doesn't, something which comes up at breakfast time, you know, it's, and I think the idea of loss, you know, what the language of loss, it's not something, you know, what I think loss for different people, they've lost something, it hasn't gone missing, and I think there's a real ambiguity with the language of miscarriage. And I think coming from where I've come from, I think it's when you're receiving that kind of news from doctors or nurses or the people who are interacting with you, you do want a bit of security. I think it's like a lot of things, it's about the balance. You want some of the hard fact, as much as you're not liking what you're hearing, but you also want the language of empathy. You want the language of this is tragic, and as you, it must be a nightmare from your side of things, because it is a, how would you know that for one person's almost arm around the shoulder approach would be a disaster, for someone else it might be the perfect, as good as it's going to get at that time. So yeah, it must be incredibly difficult, but I think it's about the language it's used.
Tabitha, did you find that it was okay for you the way things were talked?
Yeah, I've got to say I felt really cared for by the staff at Liverpool Women's Hospital, and the language they used, they pitched it just right for me. I had enough time to ask questions. They gave me leaflets that the baby stopped growing, and then I actually had took the tablet and had the procedure a few weeks later. So I had all that time to go and Google what the situation I was in, and I think that the actual printed leaflet I was given after the face-to-face interview or conversation was pitched just right for me. So yeah, I've got to say the NHS was great in that respect.
On that note, that's a very good note actually to end, where we are, knowing that, you know, sometimes we do get it right, and it's always going to be difficult, it's never going to be easy, but I think people do care, and I think the work that you're doing and your bravery in talking about it and producing work about it is incredibly helpful to other people. So thank you to both of you, and thank you Simon Fish, and thank you Leslie Reagan for joining us for this discussion, and thank all of you for coming. Thank you.
To find out more about Fertility Fest, visit the website fertilityfest.com. You can find all the social media links and hear all the sessions we recorded and watch the videos we made too. And of course, make sure you don't miss anything about next year's event. If you've enjoyed listening and would like to hear more content about issues affecting your fertility, then I've been making the Fertility Podcast for over 4 years now. I speak to experts all around the globe, as well as people sharing their stories. There's over 100 episodes for you to listen to at thefertilitypodcast.com. Plus, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spreaker, Spotify, any podcast app you've got on your phone. All this audio content is available for you in all the main podcast platforms.